the most interesting guests in the music industry, entertainment, art, and politics. Step into the studio for Turning Point with Frank McKay.
This week on Turning Point with Frank McKay, Louise Harrison, the sister of the late George Harrison of the Beatles, talks with Frank about growing up with George and what it was like living through the height of Beatlemania.
And now, Turning Point with Frank McKay.
Welcome to Turning Point. Our very special guest today is Louise Harrison. She is the sister of George Harrison, the late, great George Harrison, and of course, one of the founding members of the Beatles. Louise, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here. Actually, at my age, it's great to be anywhere.
You're 81 years old, you were just telling me.
Yeah, that's only in Earth years, of course.
Yeah, isn't it?
I'm still, you know, the eternal 25-year-old.
81 is the new 41 or something, right? Isn't there something like that?
Something like that, yeah. Right. Who cares about numbers anyway?
That's true. And you're calling from Sarasota, Florida. Glad to have part of the Beatle family, another part of the Beatle family, solidly here in America.
I've been here now. In March of next year, I will have been here 50 years.
Oh, you've been here longer than I've been here.
Probably. Longer than a lot of people have been here, actually.
Yeah, that's something. When was your first visit to the States?
Well, let me see. I visited the States probably in 1960 when I went to New York. When I was married to a very, very brilliant engineer. We went to New York for an interview with a mining company from Peru. And we were interviewed, and later my husband was hired, and we moved to Peru in South America. So that was my first actual visit into New York. But then later in 1963, I moved into the country as a permanent resident alien. So,
Well, I know from just my Beatle history that you weren't a blue blood. That's for sure. You were raised by hardworking middle-class people, right? In fact, your dad was a school bus driver, was he?
No, a regular bus driver.
A regular bus driver.
The public bus system. You see, that's one of the great things about Britain, which unfortunately this country was a bit too vast to get going properly, but we do have a really good public transport system over there, which is a whole lot better to get around. You don't have to just, only go places with your own car. So it helps to reduce the pollution a little bit, and it makes it easier to get around by having a good public transport system. But that's what he was in, the Liverpool Passenger Transport Company.
What were your parents like? Were they strict?
They were fantastic. In some ways, they were strict, but not in any way that ever restricted my adventurous spirit. I've just got finished putting together my memoir, finished writing it now, and it's just a matter of refining it a little bit and gathering together photographs and documents and things like that to go with it. But in that, when I'm talking, remembering my childhood in the book, I'm remembering just how much freedom that back in those days, in the early 30s. One incident that I was talking about was going to a zoo with my parents. And I was, allowed to roam around quite freely. And I happened to find myself near a bunch of people that was going up a ladder up onto an elephant. And I went up the ladder with them and got up on top of the elephant. And I'm riding around on top of this elephant, and that thing, of course, is lurching and almost falling out of the seat. And I could see my mum across the field there, and they were shouting, "Lulu, where are you?" And I yelled, and I said, "Hey, I'm over here." And they look up and they said, "What are you doing up there?" And I said, "I'm having an elephant ride." And they said, "How did you get up there?" And I said, "I went up the ladder." But back in those days, there wasn't the same kind of paranoia about a child wandering off. And, I was never ever told don't talk to strangers. I mean, I never knew any strangers because I just talked to everybody. So, from the kind of childhood that I had, maybe it's made me a bit obnoxious, but, I've just been friends with everybody ever since.
And how about siblings? How many, we know about your famous, most famous
the one,
sibling.
That one. Yeah, he was their last effort. They got it right, finally. I had three brothers. I was the first one. I was their first big mistake. And, you know, they had me in 1931. And then my first brother was in 1934, Harry. The next one didn't come until 1940, and that was Peter. And then finally George in 1943. And at that point, my parents said, okay, enough's enough, you know.
And they broke the mold with George.
They sure did.
And what was he like as a little boy? What was your earliest memories of his personality?
Well, you know, I try not to talk too much about his childhood because, you know, after he became a Beatle, every aspect of his life was delved into in such detail that there wasn't even any remote thing that was private for him. And so I've made it a point to be very, very cautious of the things, you know, that I say about him. Now, there's absolutely nothing about him that would, you know, that I wouldn't be able to say, because he was a very, very wonderful, very obliging, sweet-natured, kind, and loving child. So, you know, there was nothing obnoxious about him. He didn't do any terrible, horrible things or anything. But I do try to keep his childhood as private as possible, in as much as I'm not going to be telling, you know, little anecdotes about him. I think in my book I have put maybe two little anecdotes about my brother as a child. But other than that, I've told people, hey, you know, let's respect that was the only time that he had in his life when he could be himself. And even though he's no longer here, let's just respect that. And so
that's fair enough.
Same to you now.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Everybody has always respected that view of mine. So you know, I know it's well received.
Well, it's very interesting that you pointed on. That's something you don't that the rest of us might not realize. I mean, he just really lost all of his privacy once he became the star, and everyone just sees the glory and everything else. But you see, as a sister, somebody who I assume is a very private. He was a very private person, George. Am I right?
Well, he tried to be. You know, he wasn't any more private than anybody else. Really, it was just that he didn't have any. You know, one of the things he said to me once, I was joking about something. Of course, we're always joking about something or other, and he said, you know, there's no point in trying to pretend, he says, because they know more about you than you know about yourself. And what they don't know, they make up. And so that's part of also, you know, why I've been writing this memoir, is to try to put right some of the crazy stories that have been out about the Beatles over the years. And, you know, just to, you know, put a bit of normality into what really happened.
How about the other boys when he met, you know, I guess he met Paul first and then John?
No, well, he did, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, you see, let's go back a little bit. I was 11 years old when George was born. And this little bit I will share with you. The day he was born, I was getting ready to go to school, and my mom called me into the bedroom, and of course, all of us kids were born at home, and to meet my new brother. And so he was about 8 hours old when I first met him. And when he was born, he was 10 and a half pounds. So he was a nice, you know, well-formed baby. He actually was 3 weeks later than his due date. And so, you know, I often joke that he waited until he was properly finished. And, you know, his fingernails were grown properly and his eyelashes were nice and long and curled. And his hair was, you know, he had a decent amount of hair on his head. He didn't have any teeth yet, but, you know, he was really beautiful, beautiful baby. And I had been accustomed to seeing lots of babies in the neighborhood, you know, in Liverpool, and they all were scrawny, horrible, smelly looking, noisy things, and I didn't have much time for them. But when I met him, when I saw him, I thought, now, you know, this is really a worthwhile baby to have, you know. So you know, he really was gorgeous as a little infant. But because I was so much older than him, obviously, you know, I was there helping him to learn how to talk and to learn how to walk and all of those things. So my perspective of him was far different than somebody that was his same age. You know, I was always the protective big sister, if you will.
Well, let me ask you this. And again, I'm not talking about early childhood, but I do remember the first time that you saw him perform on stage.
Oh, yeah. Okay, well, that happened in Illinois. And as a matter of fact, it's going to be 50 years since Inside event is going to be next September. And I've just recently been talking with the people in Southern Illinois about putting together a big kind of a celebration. I know a lot of the people who are listening may know, you know, different parts of Beatle history, but he did visit Illinois. He was the very, very first Beatle to ever come into the United States. But he came to visit me in 1963 in Illinois. And so it'll be the 50th anniversary of that visit next September. And we plan to, you know, have a whole big celebration of that. But now, you were asking about when he met the other Beatles. I had already moved to this country in 63, so when they were getting together, I was not around to know just, you know, how and when they all met each other. But I do know that he met Paul. Paul and he both went to the same school in Liverpool, the Liverpool Institute. And then Paul had been introduced to John Lennon. And at that point, when John asked Paul to join his band, Paul said, well, you know, I know a guy who's a pretty good guitar player, and that was how that whole thing evolved. But that story, again, is so well known that, you know, it's hardly even worth my while talking about it.
Sure, that's legend at this point. That's
legendary, yeah.
It's amazing how your brother is, you know, a quarter member of something, you can't even say some people, right, but something that changed the world. I mean, certainly music world and entertainment world, but also culturally, and you know, even the way we view certain religion, certain Eastern religion. Your brother was a major force in that.
Yeah.
But this is not simply a successful band that we're talking about. This is a phenomenon.
Oh no! It was a whole philosophy, and I don't know, a lot of adjustments.
Turning Point with Frank McKay returns right after this. Welcome back to Turning Point with Frank McKay.
Louise Harrison, sister of George Harrison, the late, great George Harrison. Louise, welcome back.
Okay, thanks for having me back.
We were discussing off mic the idea that the Beatles, it's beyond a successful band or it's beyond a successful musical act. This is something, a phenomenon. That simply changed the world.
Yeah.
Changed everything.
I sort of draw a conclusion toward the end of my book that I talk about all of the people, including myself, who were instrumental in the early, helping to get them going and helping to get them recognition and all of that kind of thing. You know, Brian and George Martin and this one and that one, all the whole bunch of us. And I say, you know, those of us who thought that we were helping to start something, we're really just like the sparkles in the tail of a comet that was just destined to streak across the universe, regardless of who else was there. It was just something that was, it had its own momentum, it was unstoppable, and it was a sight that was a positive sign for everybody that saw it. I think that sort of sums it up. To me, that's the best way I could sum it up.
And it was something in your mind that was just inevitable. I mean, it just, the stars lined up with the moon, and here are this great musical act and this great collection of personalities created this. Let me ask you your personal, I don't mean opinions, but your impressions of, first of all, John Lennon.
Yeah, well, I first met all of them when they came to do the Ed Sullivan Show in New York in 1964. I had flown in from the Midwest, where George had visited me the previous year, and arrived at the Plaza Hotel. So they were all at the Plaza Hotel. They were all in a really, really state of high excitement because they were watching on all the different TVs in the suite their arrival on TV, you know, the reports of their arrival. So everything was just very, very, you know, exciting and so on. And John and Cynthia were both there. Well, you know, when I first met all of them, you know, we all hugged and George introduced me to them all, you know, this is my sister. So to me, it was like having an extra three brothers all in, you know, ready-made all in one go. And in many, many ways, I've felt that way about them ever since. That, obviously they were my kid brothers, buddies. And so to me, they were just like other brothers. And I felt the same kind of air of protectiveness toward them because, again, you know, I was older than all of them and, you know, the senior kind of person there. So the only thing about John that I would say was initially there was a couple of times when his wit and his sarcastic wit sort of threw me a couple of times, and I thought, oh my gosh, I wonder if he doesn't like me. And I happened to be talking to my mom on the phone. She was back in England, and I said, hey, you know, I'm a little bit concerned about John, you know. And I mentioned a couple of things he said, and she said, oh, that's just his protective covering. She said, he's so vulnerable and so easily hurt that he throws up this big smokescreen of protection around himself with his wit and his kind of sarcasm and all those kind of remarks. She said, but, you know, truly, she said, he's just a really very, very vulnerable soul. And she said, you know, be kind to him, treat him kindly, you know. So that was, and of course, my mum knew, you know, George, Paul, and John very, very well because, of course, obviously George was her son, but both Paul and John had lost their mothers during their teen years, and my mum had kind of been the fill-in mum for all three of them, and, just, you know, so much so that George used to be very concerned knowing that his other two buddies had lost their mother, that, you know, he was kind of super specially concerned about mom. She used to go out riding on a bike and everything in the rain, and he'd say, oh, be careful, you know, you're the only mum we've got between us, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that was quite a part of their makeup, too.
How in touch with each other are the Beatles family? I think you referred off mic to the Beatle family, and I guess that would include the relatives of the Beatles.
That wasn't exactly the family that I meant, but the Beatle family of the biological, you know, relatives, mothers and fathers and so on, they were very closely connected during those days in Liverpool, you know, during the whole Beatlemania thing, because let's face it, they were the only people who actually understood that experience that they were going through. And so they did, there was a closeness between them because they had to kind of hang together as a unit that was experiencing this wild and rocky ride, you know, across the planet. So they were very, very close. But when I was talking about my family, I meant that in the intervening years since 1964, which is almost 50 years now, I've been, to many, many Beatle fans, considered like the mum. Because first of all, my mum and dad answered mail from from fans from all over the world, and they, you know, they started calling my mum and dad, and so initially, mum and dad were what I call the global parents of the family. But to me now that my mum and dad have gone, I've kind of taken over the role of being the global mum, and to me, all of the Beatle people across the world are my extended global family, and that's how I regard them. And so, to me, if somebody is under 30 and they're a Beatle person, then I'm their Nana Lou. You know, and that's just the way I've been for the last, you know, almost 50 years now.
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. What about the other relatives of the Beatles? For example, Yoko Ono. Do you have a relationship with Yoko?
No.
You don't. Do you, I don't know if you want to comment on it, but do you
no.
share the view? Do you share the view that many people share that Yoko was the cause of the demise of the Beatles?
I have no comment.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. We'll leave it at that.
How
about folks like Julian and Cynthia and Sean Lennon? Are they people that you keep in touch with?
No, I and, you know, the Beatles, the remaining Beatles as well. I never ever made a point of pushing myself into any of their private lives. Well, for one thing, I was living in the United States.
Right.
And, was, you know, and in South America and here and there and Canada, I was all over the place. So, you know, I wasn't really in a spot to be close to anybody. And I, you know, had my own life anyway, which was pretty interesting. So, it, you know, it never occurred to me to try to stay close to them, especially when there were so many thousands of people wanting to be part of their lives anyway, you know, for various purposes, most of which were not too, you know, not too kind. They were more trying to help themselves. But So I just felt they were so besieged by people all across the world that I didn't want to be part of another one of the besiegers. So, you know, that's been my take on it, just to, you know, whenever there's a time comes by that I am in a situation, like, for instance, for the last few years when Paul has been touring, he's usually had maybe one of his assistants give me a call and say, hey, do you want to come to the show? We'll leave you some tickets, that kind of thing. So, in that respect, I have a relationship, but not to the point where I go pushing myself into their lives. Actually, Paul sent me a birthday card on my 80th birthday, which was very, very nice of him, very thoughtful of him to do that.
That's very nice. Let me ask you this. The founding of religion from your brother, when your brother found Eastern philosophy and found religion, what was the reaction of yourself being here and your parents? And I assume they were back in Liverpool.
Yeah. Well, you know, in many ways, and again, I go into this in the book, in many ways, the teachings, you know, he studied many, many different teachings from, you know, all different things, Buddha, Hindu, Muslim, Christian, Judeo. He tried to get a take on all of them to see, you know, why are these people all fighting each other all the time, you know? And he came to the conclusion that really, it's all very silly, all this whole religious diversion and, you know, hate and everything that's going on in the world, because basically just about everybody believes that there's one creator that, you know, started everything off and maybe had enough sense to make the seasons and, you know, make the ecosystem so that we can live in it, that kind of thing. And so a lot of what he learned in his spiritual quest, it had to do with some of the stuff that my dad would talk about when we were kids. And he would say things like, you know, there's just one creator. And, you know, what makes us alive is that we have a little bit of that creator, you know, a little bit of whatever that creator is. Like maybe in a Star Trek movie, it was depicted once as a great big mass of vibrating intelligent energy. And he kind of used that sort of an idea that the creator itself is perhaps a mass of intelligent energy, and we all have a little spark of that gives us our life, the life force. And so his attitude was, you know, we really don't need to be fighting each other because we're all part of the same thing. So, you know, when George started going through all of these other religions, he found that there was an underlying message that was basically that same thing, that we are all one, really, in the Creator.
Were your parents churchgoers?
No.
They weren't?
No. And again, that's something I go into in my book quite much. The whole thing about organized religion, it doesn't have anything to do with real spirituality. It just has to do with how many people are going to put the money in the plate on a Sunday and how many minds they can control, you know. So, how many people they can get to hate the other bunch of people.
I think so, more people agree with you now than certainly while George was going through that. And I think you saw the insanity happen when John Lennon said the bigger than the Jesus quote, and the overreaction of people burning the albums and everything else. You wouldn't have, well, actually, I shouldn't say that. You might have some of that nowadays, but it certainly wouldn't.
Oh, yeah, you do have some extreme rightists now, let's face it, But I think perhaps there's a little bit of evolution happening in as much as people are getting to be, you know, let's face it, there's more knowledge in the world now than when I was a child, just simply from all of the technology that has evolved. And there's so much more information that we are capable of gaining just by going on the Internet. Not that all of the stuff on the Internet is necessarily true, but one is exposed to far more knowledge than, you know, many, many years ago. And I think, again, I think there was a thing streaming on the TV the little few hours ago saying that now, for the first time, this country does not have a predominance of Protestants. And again, I think it's an awakening of people realizing that whole religious that you've got to conform to one particular brand is not really making sense anymore to people who do realize that, you know, that there is possibly, well, in my, you know, to my belief, one creator, and that we're all part of it, and that why don't we just, you know, get together and be kind to each other, because that's really what we're here for, I think.
Turning Point with Frank McKay returns right after this. Welcome back to Turning Point with Frank McKay.
Louise, welcome back. On another note, and a very serious and disturbing note, when John Lennon was assassinated, were your parents alive?
1980. No.
They weren't. Yeah, I was going to say that. What was, it's almost a rhetorical question, but it was their fear from you and other members of the family that, my God, you know, there's mad people out there that very well are shooting Beatles now. I mean, this is unbelievable.
Yeah, no, both my parents died in the 70s, but I remember the night very, very well when John was shot. I was at home in my house in Sarasota, and I had gone to bed early that night, and somebody called me after I'd gone to bed, and they said, "Are you watching TV?" And there was such a tone in their voice that I thought, oh my God, something's happened to George. And they said, "Turn the TV on." I said, "Why, what's happened? And they said, "Oh, they're reporting that John was shot." Well, that was one moment in my life when I had two totally opposite emotions at the same moment. One was horror at the idea that John was shot, and the other one was relief that it wasn't George.
Right.
Because the tone in this person's voice, when she said, "You're watching TV," I thought something's happened to George. Well, you know, subsequently, after that, George did become very concerned. He said, you know, there's so many lunatics out there, you know, try to keep a low profile because, you know, they get the name in the paper by shooting somebody that's connected to somebody who's famous, you know. And so for many years, I did stay quiet. It was just in the 90s when I started an environmental organization that I said, okay, you know, I'm not scared of somebody shooting me. Yeah, let's face it, I was already at that point older than my mom and dad and older than George. So, you know, I thought I'm not scared of that happening. And I thought it was worthwhile getting out amongst the Beatle people of the world to try to raise awareness about some of the problems that we do have on this planet, like the, you know, the concern for our ecosystem and for the health of our planet, as well as for the health of our society, in as much as what we were just talking about, the hatred and stuff that's engendered by keeping stuck to a particular way of looking at God, you know.
Yeah. Oh, well, the night that George, or the day that that you had heard about George being attacked, your emotions, and, you know, again, some of that's a rhetorical question. I can imagine what they were.
Yeah.
But your reaction to that, and how did you hear about that?
Well, again, it was, I guess, the TV or somebody calling me. I can't remember now. But I know the next day I had TV cameras running up, coming up to my house all day long, asking me what did I think about it, you know. And thank God he was able to survive from that. But, however, I do think that stabbing probably made his, you know, he was, I think, in somewhat of a remission with his lung cancer. And I think, you know, being stabbed like that in the chest sort of set the cancer, you know, flowing through the body. It probably would have maybe lived, you know, been cured and lived longer had that not happened. But there, I'm only guessing. I don't really know. I'm not a doctor, you know.
When did you speak to him after that? You know, subsequent
to that. Well, we were constantly in touch. You know, I couldn't remember at specific times, but you know, one of the things he always said to me was, you know, whatever's going on, I'm no farther away than the end of a telephone line. You know, so we did talk a lot on the phone.
Yeah. Now,
of course, whenever he was in the same part of the planet as I was, then we would, you know, get together too.
Now, let me ask you, if I could. Mm-hmm. Your personal collection, and I don't mean this from a fan standpoint, but is your house a museum of the Beatles? I'm sure people would like to know. Does it look like a shrine to George? And to,
No. As a matter of fact, I did have boxes of all kinds of memorabilia, and when people would come to visit me, I would take it out and show them it. And unfortunately, over the years, things that were in those collection boxes got stuck to people's fingers as they were leaving to the house, and I have practically nothing at all.
Nothing, that's funny. Do you, are you a Beatles fan?
Of course. Yeah. Probably, you know, next to my mom and dad, one of the first ones.
Anything you'd like to talk about? I know you referenced your book. When can we expect to see the first copy? And do you have a publisher? Are you?
Yes. It's going to be published by. Pardon me, my voice is a bit croaky. It's going to be published by Southern Illinois University Press, which I used to be friends when I had my environmental organization. I was friends with a lot of legislators in Illinois, including Senator Paul Simon. You know, the guy who used to always wear a little bow tie. And he had written a book that was published by the University Press. It was called something about pandering, about how politicians pander to their
Are you sure that wasn't Tsongas?
Voters.
Was that Paul Simon?
Pardon?
Maybe that was Paul Tsongas?
No, Paul Simon.
Yeah.
Paul Simon. He was a senator in Illinois.
Yeah, I know. With the bow tie.
And he was very supportive of my environmental efforts, and he sent me this book, Something of Pandering. It was talking about, you know, how politicians pander to their people that want to vote for them. And we've seen evidence of that in the recent couple of weeks, you know, where a person's saying one thing for a couple of years to one lot of people, and then suddenly when he thinks there's another lot of people listening, he changes his tune altogether, you know. And that's the kind of thing that Paul Simon was talking about. But anyway, when I was looking at his book, when I was thinking about wanting a publisher, I thought, well, I don't really want to go with all of these big boys, you know, the big publishing companies, because I found from people that have talked to them that in maybe me putting out a book, the main thing they would be interested in is, does she have any dirt, you know? Has she got any nasty stuff about the Beatles, you know? Well, that's not the kind of book that I'm interested in writing. I'm writing a book that is perhaps a little bit academic, in as much as some of the opinions and things that I've learned over 80 years on this planet. So, you know, apart from it being my memoir, it's also I'm trying to give a little insight to my global family of Beatle people of some of the things that I've learned. So it is more of an academic book. So that's why I wanted to go with the university. And I thought also, if there's anybody going to make a bit of a profit out of my book, I'd rather it go to some academia rather than to some big, rich corporate plate people on Wall Street or somewhere, you know. So, you know, that's just my feeling about it. So what I've been talking with them, I've got the thing all pretty well done, the whole book. Unfortunately, I keep on adding bits to it, but I've got to stop doing that. But we are planning on having a release date for it on the 16th of September next year.
Oh, wow.
And the reason for that is it's going to take them, you know, almost to then to get it ready anyway from, you know, from where it is right now. But it occurred to me that on the 16th of September, it is the 50th anniversary of when George became the first Beatle to enter the United States. Mm. So I thought, you know, that date in
Very
itself is newsworthy.
Right. Yeah, that's,
you know,
that's appropriate.
And the people in Southern Illinois, we're going to get together with the tourism board and the historical society, who are already planning on giving a plaque to the house that I lived in, the house that George visited, to say that it is a historical monument, basically 50 years since his visit. So, you know, there's quite a good potential for a lot of things to happen in Southern Illinois on that date. And so we're going to launch my book at that same time.
Well, I tell you, it's been a fascinating conversation with you. This is Nana Lou we've been speaking with. Louise Harrison, the sister of George Harrison. And look for next September 16th, 2013, for her book. Is there a title?
It's called The Harrison Hug.
The Hug is H-U-G?
H-U-G, yeah. And that came about because back a little while ago, you know, before George died, obviously, but the last time he gave me a big hug, he said to me, pass it on. So I've been passing his hug on, and I've been saying to people, okay, this is a hug from George, and you must pass it on. And so what's happening is that since I started doing that back in 2002, I've had emails from people. One person sent me an email. She said, I got a Harrison hug for my birthday from somebody. She was in Argentina. She said, I had a Harrison hug for my birthday that you gave it to in Cleveland in 2003.
Wow.
And then I had another text short a little while ago saying, I have now given my Harrison hug to people in 17 different countries. So one of the things I'm going to be doing is starting probably some kind of a Harrison hug place that people can come on the internet and, you know, tell about their Harrison hugs. And I thought, you know, that makes a good name for my book because, you know, already it's showing that George's love is circling the globe by people passing on his hug.
That's wonderful. What a wonderful, positive outlook you have on everything. And the world is certainly a better place for having folks like Nana Lou, again, Louise Harrison. Thank you very much for your time here.
Thanks.
And I can't wait for the book, yeah. The Harrison Hug. And it's a wonderful concept. I think your brother would approve.
Well, I was lucky that I had wonderful parents. George and I had wonderful parents. And if there's anything good about me, it's because I listened to them.
Thank you very much for being here, and thank you for tuning in. Again, here at Turning Point, our very special guest is Nana Lou, Louise Harrison, sister of George Harrison. Thank you, and we'll see you next week.
Turning Point with Frank McKay is brought to you by Herman Katz, Cam Jenny and Klein, Duffy and Duffy, and Gold Coast Bank. Turning Point with Frank McKay was produced by Out of the Box Studios in Bohemia, New York. Executive producers Frank McKay and Harry Oates. Director of Operations Corey Arnold. Audio and Studio Engineering Francis Kazmarek. And James DeZigo of Sage Studios. Webmaster Eric Soule. Radio segment producer James DeZigo. Hotel and accommodations provided by Ohika Castle Hotel and Estates in Huntington, New York. Transportation services provided by Mark of Elegance Limousine in Hop Hog, New York. Catering services provided by Windows on the Lake in Ronkonkoma, New York.